All right. Welcome to the third show, the show where I do whatever the fuck I want to do, and you don't get any plugs or anything. This week, I have Army Strang. Which name should I call you? Francis, okay?
Yeah, you can call me Francis.
Not your last name, though, right? No last names.
I don't really publicize it, but it's not hard to find my last name.
Scary, right? You like, I've had people on like where they're like, don't say my last name, don't say my first name. I'm like, man, I'm sorry, I didn't even think about it, because I'm completely open with everything that I do.
Now, and you know, if I wasn't still in the military, I mean, I don't think that if anybody went to my commander with like a list of my tweets, I think my commander would just be confused as to why anybody is bringing them printed out shit that comes from some asshole online. And then he would look at me and I'd be like, yeah, I tweeted those things. He'd be like, all right, go away.
I'm actually real interested about that. Like, do you get heat when you go to work from people?
Well, what do you mean?
Like, I mean, for the listeners, Francis is a socialist. He does a podcast called What a Hell of a Way to Die with a theme song that I sing all day, every day. And he talks about military issues from a left perspective, which seems like it would be very unpopular in the military. And heat is a wrestling term for do people feel a little mad at you. You know what I mean? Like, do you ever get a vibe that people are pissed? Because I've seen the comments on the stories you write for Task and Purpose. And I mean, people get pretty mad at you on there.
You know, well, I don't... The thing about the online internet veteran is that they're always angry. There's actually the angry internet veteran who got out of the military and is very upset that every time that he's, you know, he goes online and he sees how his army is changing and they're, you know, letting the gays serve openly and now they're going to let the transgendered in. God damn it, they didn't do that. And, you know, that guy is sitting there. He's got a goatee, a beer gut. He's on his like third six pack of the evening and just drunk and angry. So I don't really pay attention to the comments. Mostly I find them funny because it's always like how, you know, broken of a human being do you have to be like, I read a thing that is obvious satire on a website dedicated to military news and information and entertainment. And I'm going to bang out four paragraphs about how this person, how dare you, may suggest that we let soldiers grow gigantic handlebar mustaches. Do you not know that with a giant handlebar mustache, you cannot get a proper seal on your protective mask and you will die of mustard gas poisoning because apparently it is still World War I?
Yeah.
So the online stuff I don't really care about. The in-person stuff is a little... It's... You know, the word communist and socialist and leftist are words that, the specific words that I don't use. I don't know if you know, also for the listeners, I'm in the Army. I'm still in the Army. I'm a reservist, so I'm part-time. So it's 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. But I also work in public affairs and media relations for the military. And I have since I joined 17 years ago. I've done it in Afghanistan. I've done it in Iraq. So you have to, you really have to know how to talk to people. So it's, you know, you get the vibes like, okay, I can tell that this person is like, I guess the big example that I have, and I think I talked about it on my podcast, but there was a guy. We had a drill weekend during the International Women's March right after Trump was inaugurated. So there was a guy there who was just at drill. He's like, his wife went there and he's just like, I don't know what the fuck she's so mad about and blah blah blah. They're not going to take away any rights for women. Jesus Christ, blah blah blah. And, you know, just listening to him go and listening to him just bitch and moan about, you know, why these people are protesting and protesting doesn't do anything. And I talked to him. I said, you know, I don't think that, you know, they're not totally, you know, people are worried about Trump, but there's also these assholes that are, like, emboldened by Trump. And that was right. I think that was, like, the day after or 2 days after Richard Spencer got his fucking dome cleaned by some dude on, which I still every once in a while go back and watch that shit because it's so fucking funny. But I said, you know, I mean, these are people now who are coming out and they're talking all this shit. They're as like, look, Nazis are coming back because of Donald Trump. And he, you know, I could see him pause for a moment and be like, oh, like, yeah, yeah, it's not just, you know, people are worried about their rights being taken away. Of course, people are going to worry about that, especially with somebody like Trump. But, you know, it's also his supporters that people are worried about. And, you know, it's you can't come out right out and say like, so, and that's why socialism is great.
Yeah.
But you can say like, look, you know, it's, you can kind of push somebody a little to the left and just be like, look, just here's a little thing that you probably don't understand or don't realize about what's going on. If you present it in a way that's non-confrontational and in a way that just, I mean, look, nobody likes Nazis. And if you tell a soldier, especially like Nazis are coming back and a Nazi got his nose busted open and ran away crying, that it's like, oh, well, yeah, fuck Nazis. It's like, okay, good. So we're coming a little bit to this. You understand now that this is a problem and these are worries that people have. So, when you know, I don't outright talk about being, you know, a leftist or a socialist or anything like that when it comes, you know, just outright, unless there are people that I know that I can talk to those, you know, talk about things like that with. But there are ways that you can kind of worm your way into the brain of somebody and be like, consider this, though. Consider something here. Consider in, you know, 5 years after your last combat tour when you're in the military, or 5 years after you get done in the Army, you're not going to have access to military health insurance anymore. So what are you going to do? Because guess what? You get out of the Army after 10 years, 15 years, you're going to find out that you are starting at the bottom of the barrel in the civilian world. Like, you get out of the Army as, like, you know, a sergeant first class or something, and you try to go get a job. If you don't have the right connections, suddenly you're going to be, you know, working an entry-level position somewhere, making, you know,
$9 an hour.
Yeah, making like minimum wage, or, you know, working at a grocery store or something like that. And so you're going to find you're top shit at one point, and then you get out of the Army and then you drop back down and you have to work your way back up again. And just like, remember all those great services that you had in the military, like, you know, housing allowance, and you had health care, and you had dental care, and maybe it wasn't the best, greatest you could ever have, but you know that if you needed a cavity filled in the Army was going to take care of it. If you broke your arm, you were not going to, you know, go bankrupt by going to the hospital.
It's socialism in a way.
It is like, and actually I had written a thing and nobody picked it up. I think I'm going to publish it probably somewhere else, but about like the military, cause there's always all these, articles that come out. It's like, is the military socialist? And it's not, because the tenets of socialism is, you know, to workers' right and workers owning, you know, owning what they make, basically, owning the means of production. You will never have that in the military because we don't produce anything other than freedom.
Yeah.
And nobody can really own freedom.
Can't quantify that either. Like, I don't know. I mean, it seems like Obamacare gave us less freedom, according to a lot of memes I read. So we're not even like, there's people that can take freedom away, and we just have to have the military like refill it for us every once in a while. The only two people I know that are in the military that I speak to regularly are you, and I know another guy that's pretty left. I wouldn't say he's a leftist, but he's got like liberal beliefs, you know? So I don't even, the only conservatives that I talk to are mad at, like, basically people that are mad at me on the internet, you know, for being anti-military, which I don't know that I necessarily am, but I guess for me, it's like, I'm anti-war all the time. But like, I don't dehumanize the troops and think that like they're all there, I guess, to do bad things. You know what I mean? I do actually, though, what you just said a few minutes ago about the about the Nazis is that, like, I've been having panic attacks lately about there being, like, white supremacists in the army, in the military now. Like, that's been freaking me out, and the police, too. Like, I feel like that they are in the...
Yeah. O'Brien. There have been white supremacists in the military for years. Years and years. White supremacists join the military to learn military tactics and take it back to their white supremacist brethren. Even back during the surge years when the military, like, really relaxed all of the... all the standards to get into the military. Whoo, boy, did we get some fucking terrible people in.
How creepy is that? Are there enough of you to, like, offset them when the shit goes down?
I fucking hope so. I mean, I can't. Here's the thing: when it comes to like literal white supremacists rising up in some kind of violent armed oppression, even most Republicans aren't gonna allow that shit. Nobody wants the Nazis to come back.
I just worry about, like, force, like, that they have, that there's an amount of them embedded in these organizations that they will just be able to take it. You know what I mean?
A white supremacist coup d'etat against take over the army. No, that won't happen either.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same. I think that way about the police, too. Like, I talked about this on Delete Your Account on the episode I did recently. Like, right after the Trump election, I laid in bed for like a week and every night had a complete meltdown because that Nazi cop in Philly with the tattoos. Do you remember that story?
Oh, yeah.
So he got to keep his job. He's back out on the streets again. And I had a meltdown for like a week because we talked about it on Street Fight. And it just, I think it finally clicked in my mind that, like, fuck, you know, white supremacists embed themselves or are a part of the fiber of the people that have all the guns. You know what I mean? The people that are in control physically of all of the guns. And it, I don't know. It just weirded me out. But then I talked to Q Mars and, you know, the more I think about it, I'm like, you know, like you said, this has been going on forever. It's not like a new thing, you know?
Yeah, and I honestly, I don't worry. Like, all my time in the military, I've never... I mean, I'm sure I've come across white supremacists, but I haven't, like... Nobody's, like, outright told me. It's like, so who here hates the blacks?
They don't do, like, that, though. Never... They'll give you hints first. The one guy I knew that was a skinhead and in a gang... back in the day, he was like the Vinlanders. I shouldn't even say that because they'll probably kill me, right? But, like, he was in this gang of, like, white supremacists, and he started telling me, like, things he liked, like the kind of music he liked, and that he, like, first he told me he liked, like, the Dropkick Murphys and stuff. Then he told me that he liked Viking shit. And he told me that he used to get wild and get into a lot of fights. And I immediately was like, this guy's a Nazi, I think. Because, I mean, he ticked too many boxes. And I finally did get him to admit that he was in a Nazi social club, a gang. Basically, they called it a social club, but that he was a Nazi. You know what I mean? So you have to look out for the hints if you're trying to sniff them out. I mean, I'm always trying to sniff them out. Maybe that's the thing, too, is, like, I'm so panicked about them that I'm just going around like, I think this guy might be a Nazi.
Well, I can, like I said, I can tell you that I don't really run into that very much. I mean, the military, honestly, you stick around in the military long enough, I feel like a lot of those white supremacist, like, thoughts and stuff are really going to kind of be pushed out of your head. We recently, Adrian on my podcast recently did one of our bonus episodes with a guy. He's out in the Ukraine, and he did a interview with a guy who is a sniper with the Swedish military, and he's fighting with the Ukrainian military now. And he did this interview, and I didn't really put out anything other than, like, here's this interview that Adrian did. And somebody on Twitter was just like, you know, that guy was involved in, like, a Swedish Nazi party. And that's the thing. Adrian had told me beforehand, he's like, this guy is a former neo-Nazi. But Adrian, who is a very left, very socialist person, is just like, but he is my friend, and I want to do this interview and, you know, listen to it, and I think it'll be, I think it'll be a good interview. And he did it, and what the guy talked about was, you know, you join the military, the military takes people from all over. Like, you know, when I went to basic training, I'm from St. Louis, the guy who I share, like, the little area that we're in basic training, the four people that were, like, closest proximity to me, one was a native Hawaiian, one was Puerto Rican, and one was a guy from Philly, I think. And then there was me from St. Louis. Like, three people I would never meet in my entire life if I didn't join the military. What the military does is that when you go to war, and this is any military, you go to war, and if I sit down and there's a squad of, you know, 7 or 10 or however many of us, and you've got me, who's a leftist, and then you've got somebody who's probably far right, and then you've got somebody who's black, and somebody who's Hispanic, and somebody, you know, and you're just like, somebody is super racist, they're like, well, I don't want to work with this black guy, I don't want to work with the Mexican guy. And the commander's like, tough shit. Guess what? Yeah. This is a squad. Go out. And the thing about a war is that you have to learn to trust somebody real quick, because it's not, you know, sitting around, you know, your house or sitting around the internet or just in your day-to-day life. I don't really rely on anybody. I rely on my wife. I rely on one or two other people. But there's not a whole lot. When I go to the grocery store, I'm not relying on the guy next to me for anything.
Yeah.
But in a war zone, when you find yourself in, you know, a firefight, you find yourself in a situation where there's bullets flying everywhere and there's just all kinds of shit happening. And if you are going to think, well, I'm not going to, you know, I don't trust that guy because of the color of his skin or because he's Hispanic, you're going to die. And they're going to die. And nobody wants to die. Even the dumbass Nazis don't want to die. And so you learn real quick. It's like, oh, well, you know, that guy is a bleeding heart liberal, socialist, leftist, communist. But, man, he can sure hit some targets, though. Like, he had my back out there. And, this guy who he's black, but, you know, and I, you know, at home, I don't like black people. But, you know, out here, he, you know, I dropped my MRE in the mud and he split his with me so I wouldn't go hungry. Like, you start to, you know, you start to. It forces you to realize that, like, the misconceptions that you have about a race that are beaten into you by all these, like, really racist stereotypes, hey, they're probably not true. And, you know, war is the great equalizer, you know, honestly. And
yeah.
So, you know, if you listen to that interview, Mikhail, he talks about, he's like, you know, you don't want to go out and you don't want to do these things, but then you're not given a choice. And then you're forced to, like, become friends with these people. And that really breaks down a lot of barriers. So True. In a lot of ways, the military is kind of good at that, because especially the American military, because, like I said, no matter where you join from, you're all thrown into the same mixing bowl and then spit out at the end.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it humanizes everybody. That's, we talk a lot about on the show about, like, a lot of the people that have, this is just an example, like a lot of the people that have, like, really strong objections to, like, trans people, the people that want to have those bathroom bills, right? That, like, it's because they've never come in contact with a trans person that's out, like, in their family. And that's probably because they don't feel safe around them, you know? And it's like, I always think that proximity to, like, if you can humanize people to somebody, you can change that sort of behavior. And, like, when you go to war, I mean, you guys, do you talk a lot with the other guys in your squad? Do you, like share secrets, like, at slumber parties or anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, when it comes to the, you know, the breakdown of, you know, of regimental, like, so a regiment will have, you know, thousands of soldiers in it, and then goes down to battalions, brigades, platoons. I think I might be getting that wrong. Some, like, actual soldier is going to yell at me about this, but when it comes down to your squad mates, you know, the in your platoon, your second squad, it's you and, like, this fire team of, like, 5 to 12 people, I mean, yeah, those are the people that you rely on. Those are the people you're working with every day. I mean, it would be like if you want to work at a regular job and then just didn't talk to anybody around you.
Now, there's listeners to this show who would say that they work a regular job and they don't talk to anybody around them.
Right, but nobody's shooting at you in your office, though. That's the thing. Like, and the military, the work you do in the military while on a deployment is much different than the work you do in an office. Like, I'm when I was in an office, I was kind of the same way. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't really have to, but when it's all of us in a gun truck or something, or just all of us out and about on a foot patrol, that proximity and that constant, I have to have your back, you have to have my back. If you don't have, that breeds that, sitting around telling each other secrets. Usually it's telling dirty stories or telling about that time you got so drunk. But for the most part, that's, you gain that bond, you gain that trust with one another. And you start telling each other secrets, or you start telling each other just about yourselves, and you start to learn about one another and kind of grow as a team. I mean, that's just bonding in general, though.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, if you work jobs where you have to be a part of a team, you tend to kind of get along with some of the people. I mean, I hear my wife say oh, I don't like my team or whatever. But I worked at a restaurant and it was really shitty. It was a really shitty situation, but I felt a lot of affection for the people I was working with because we were all in the same shitty situation, I was able to make friends with them. So I would probably you go out there and you build bonds. I was wondering if it was a relationship with people at work or a relationship where you're you can call me anytime. Cause they on TV, the troops are you can call me anytime and have a network. But I know that it's not kind of really like that. A lot of people keep things bottled up. Like they decide not to talk about these things.
Yeah. Mental health has been a real problem with the military. Because it's always hard to be I have to go talk to somebody, because you spend so much time, being invincible, basically. I mean, you go to Iraq, you go to Afghanistan, you get hit by roadside bombs, you get shot at, bullets whiz by you but never hit you, and then you come home and you have to integrate yourself back into the civilian life, and, some people, it doesn't work as well for other people. A lot of people see going to see a mental health specialist as a kind of a mark, a weakness. And
right. I think that's common with there. I mean, that's even just a macho fucking thing. You know what I mean? A lot of guys feel it. It's still in 2017. People are running around I ain't going to see no shrink.
Right. And a therapist, and I'll tell you, I will street fight exclusive. I went to see a mental health specialist after my my last deployment.
I would expect that from you. The other guy that I know goes, he gets help too, and he posts once a day. He posts that suicide hotline number. It's something that's real striking to me because it's these are just people that have nobody to talk to, I guess, or feel very alone in the world. Well,
and that is the problem when it comes to, as we were talking about that bond between your squad mates, you have to have sometimes that final one of saying, I need help, is the one that is really hard to jump over. And we are supposed to be there for each other at all times. I have a buddy that he's not even in the military anymore. And I'm holding on, his wife asked me to hold on to all of his guns because he had, a month ago, shot up his bedroom. And he had texted me right after that. He's like, well, I just shot up my bedroom to keep myself from committing suicide. And I was like, okay, we need to move on this immediately. And his wife brought over all the guns and we made sure that he's seeing somebody. It's like, you can go to, if you don't want to go to the VA, his wife has health insurance. You've got somebody at this point. And it's you cannot, you can't shoot up your bedroom. and then say, yeah, I'm fine afterwards. Like, you don't, nobody does that. Nobody shoots up a bedroom and then it's just like the next day is like, no, that was just a fluke. I'm fine.
No, you're exactly right. There was like I had an incident. It's like when I went to rehab, I decided to go to rehab. I'm driving home from work, right? And I'm crying. I cry for 30 seconds like a baby, like I was somebody, like I hadn't cried since I was a kid. And within 30 seconds after that, I would start laughing because I was crying, and then I would start crying again. And as I was driving home, I was like, something's got to fucking change. You know what I mean? Like, that's not something you go back to. Like, it's a thing, like you'll step over a line and be like, I got to do something about this or something bad's going to happen, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that people, you got to have that come to Jesus moment, you know, where you're just like, okay, there's obviously something not right here. And that's what it was for me. Like, I got the girl that I was in love with, you know, dumped me while I was on deployment to Iraq.
That just happens to every one of you guys. I'm very sorry.
No, and you know, I mean, looking back on it in hindsight, I can't, you know, I'm not angry at her about it. I understand why it happened. I was not as communicative as I should have been. You know, and that's something that my current wife, like when I had to go and do like a 3 week 3 week training somewhere like in California or something, and we'd been together for about a year and a half, and I really just kind of, you know, when I'm on military time, you know, especially, you know, in a training environment, I am, you know, 100% focused on what I'm doing. I move back and forth between a civilian mindset and a military mindset. And she was just like, okay, look, you need to stop that and you need to talk to me. You can't, and now anytime I go, I just like, I always make sure we talk on the phone. You know, if I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks, it's like, all right, each week we're going to talk on the phone, you know, twice during the week, and, you know, just to have voice contact and everything, because otherwise I know that I'm going to put up walls all around me, because that's just what I do. But I want to, you know, I came back from Iraq, and I was just angry. Like, I was mad, and I came back, and my job didn't exist anymore, so I came home, and I didn't have a job, and I didn't have a girlfriend, and I was just angry at the world. And you know, going into a mental health specialist or seeing a therapist, like, I didn't realize at the time exactly why it was so great. But when you have like a third party person who has no like real emotional investment in you, like, you can talk to a friend all you want, but like, for some reason, having somebody who is like outside of your circle of friends that you can just dump everything on, because I don't care what she thinks about me. I don't care what the mental health person thinks about me. And that was just a huge weight off the mind. Like, I talked to her for an hour. I mean, for me, I was just like, all right, I'm good. I talked, I cried for a minute, and I think I'm all right now. And I appreciate you being here for me.
Right. And the friends thing, the thing about talking to friends is that, like, that conversation has so much baggage fucking wrapped up into it that, like, it's not their responsibility to change you or anything. And, like, you don't even know if you're doing what's good for the two of you. You don't know what kind of motives you have. You know what I mean? When it comes to these, you don't want to hurt people that you're close to's feelings by talking to them. I should go to a therapist. I probably should. But, like, I just smoke a bunch of marijuana. You know?
I know, yeah, and I tell you, my buddy who I had to take the guns from, he stopped drinking and he started smoking weed, and he's just like, oh man, I'm doing art now, and I'm writing more, and I'm just feeling so good. I'm like, fuck, why is this shit still illegal? Like, right. just seeing him go from, because when his wife dropped his guns off with me, it was a Sunday at like 10:30 in the morning, and she was like, he asked me to pick him up a six pack on the way home. I was like, dude, it is 10:30 on a Sunday, and we're not going to a barbecue, so no.
Yeah,
and I was like, yeah, so, I mean, that should be, like, a real wake-up call for him, and apparently it was. She was like, she told him, if you want to get your guns back, you have to quit drinking, and so he found something else, but apparently the weed really mellows him out, so, you know, more power to him.
there, I mean, like, I have people in my life that, like, obviously not from the military, but that have just been through some shit. You know what I mean? Living in poverty is tough, you know? It's like,
oh, yeah.
And when, like, you're struggling for everything, and they just kind of got over that hump where they're living comfortably. And they had been drinking a lot when they were broke, and they were just trying to, like, try something else, and had been having these meltdowns at night. Like, they would just have these, like, bouts with self-consciousness, and where you just kind of lay in bed and you analyze every social interaction you've had for the day and realize that, like, you were the worst part of all of them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you start to think, like, okay, so this person said this, but they really meant this. And you just try to read each other wrong, usually because of baggage in a relationship. And I was like, a lot of people are really finding that weed makes them not feel so stressed. And, like, just because and that's just happening because there's less of a stigma on it. And it's a miracle, like, what this thing that I, you know, kind of has always been looked at as, like, a goofy habit is doing for people. And, like, Stefan BC from he's the Canna Barrister. We've talked to him a lot. And one of the people that he represents, one of the groups he represents often, is a veterans group who will show up to an office. Show up to the office of some kind of a senator or whatever, you know, House of Representatives guy, and dump all of their prescription pills on a table and say, this is all I need. Like, the marijuana is the thing that has made me feel better. And, you know, and the military's against marijuana, right?
We do drug test for it, and yes, you'll get kicked out if it turns out that you've got it in your system.
Right, and
it goes back and forth,
only,
but yeah, it's a negative. They don't like it.
And drug tests are really only for marijuana because it's
They drug test for the military. Drug tests for a lot of stuff.
Right. No, like, but marijuana is the only thing that stays in your system for any amount of time. Most of that other stuff's out of there in like 2 or 3 days. You know. And, you know, most people are addicted to prescription drugs now anyway. It's, you know, Oxycontin or fucking Xanax, one or the other.
Yeah, and the military actually tests for prescription pills, too.
Yeah, I can't imagine they can let you guys be on Xanax when you're at war. That would...
Oh, no. I mean, that's fine. Like, the thing is that they want to make sure, like, if I did a piss test and...
Piss hot.
Well, yeah, if I pissed hot for, I know they don't test for Xanax because everybody's on Xanax.
Crazy.
But, like, if I pissed, my dog's on fucking Xanax. Are you kidding me? This is America.
I can't get my hands on it at all, man. Everybody's like, you're going to enjoy that too. I guess. I guess I can get some right now.
Well,
I know a few people.
my wife has a prescription for like a quarter milligram.
Those teeny tiny baby ones.
Right, that she does. I mean, she takes one like a month. Like, it's not even. And I took one time, and it didn't do anything. And she was like, "Of course not. You're not anxious all the time. Like, you don't have anxiety like, you know, like other people do." And my dog has a full milligram of doggy Xanax because anytime a storm comes through, he just turns into a fucking puddle. So if I look at the radar, it's like, oh, a storm's going to come here in about a half hour. I'll just drug the dog up. I mean, he's still a mess, but at least he's quiet.
That's fucking great, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Giving the dog Xanax is one of the cooler things on this show I've ever heard.
It's great. And yeah, it's an anxiety. Like, he's a mess in the brain. And I mean, there's really nothing we can do to change it because he's like 7 years old now. But yeah, I just give him a little peanut butter with his Xanax in the middle of it. And he chills out, which is pretty nice.
Right.
Yeah, they'll test the army. If I pissed hot for like oxycodone or Oxycontin or anything, they would come back. They'd be like, okay, you pissed hot for this. We need to see a prescription. I just present the prescription and the doctor that prescribed it. And they'll be like, we gave it to him for X, Y, and Z. And then it's okay. I mean, if I pissed hot for oxycodone and didn't have a prescription for it, that's a problem.
Yeah. That is like, Yeah, that's like when you try to get a job, only they check for more stuff. But the reason I say they're only really checking for marijuana is because all the other stuff is out in like 2 or 3 days. So all drug tests are really able to catch is weed, because it can be in your system for like 30 days.
Yeah, unless you're dumb enough to be doing rails of blow the night before before going into drill. And actually, in the active duty side, it's more there's more of a chance of catching you for that, because that's random. But for me, like, I know, like, they don't drug test us every month, but I know when the drug tests are coming. Well, I know when the drill weekend is coming. So if anybody pisses hot on a drug test in the reserves, you're just not trying. Like, that's just like, I don't know why you thought that you could, smoke weed 4 days before we had drill and get away with it. Like, that's ridiculous. Why are you that stupid?
Well, how are they dealing with people with medical marijuana prescriptions? Are they having, is that coming up in the thing?
Marijuana is still federally illegal. Therefore, it is still federally illegal for your federal military. So even if you're a Colorado soldier, if you're on a base in Colorado, you're on a base in Washington, still illegal. And they will still, if you're in Washington State on a Joint Base Lewis-McChord and you piss hot for marijuana, you're fucked.
Damn, that sucks. Yep. That is just, I mean, it is really something that would help some of the more high strung guys that are involved in the military. And I honestly think some of the older veterans that are out could really, I know they're allowed to, but I think also there's certain messaging about it that keeps them from wanting to. Like, if the military could recommend, like, hey, when you get out of this, see if marijuana works for you. And I think some of these older guys that are commenting on the internet would probably cool out a little bit about it.
Well, and I think about with a lot of soldiers who may have joined years ago and they're getting out now, and if they wanted to try marijuana, weed's fucking complicated these days, man. Like, just listening to you guys talk about it, like, back in my day, we just smoked the shit and we're done with it. And like, now it's like, well, we put it in our vape pens and we eat it, and we go in and like, this side is if you want to get mellow, this side is if you want to get really high, these are the ones, if you take 4 hits you'll be feeling really good, but you take that 5th one and then you're really going to melt into a puddle. And it's like, Jesus, whatever happened to just smoking some ditch weed, getting a headache and going to bed?
Yeah, I'm walking around with a $300 vaporizer that has like Bluetooth on my phone, so I can control the temperature. It's like it's metal. It is the most beautiful machine, and it gets me so fucking high that it's like, it's my only use, right? And the weed that I'm smoking is called Illudium. And it's some weird strain that is an Ohio indigenous thing. Like, the person who invented it or whatever, figured it out, is from Ohio. And I've been walking around kind of saying that, and I'm like, oh shit, man. The weed guy culture is catching up to me, because I'm just a guy that I just smoke, right? Up until about 4 months ago, I smoked it out of a glass bowl, and just, I didn't know what kind I had. But then I quit smoking cigarettes like 10 years ago, and I just nagged at me that I still smoked weed, and I wanted to stop because I think there's a million different ways to do it now. And now I'm eating it and only vaping it. It's wonderful, though, man. When you're getting out of that military, hit me up. I'll come to St. Louis and get you high.
I always joked about that with my wife. It's like, I'm going to get out of the military. Like, the day they hand me my retirement papers, I'm going to break up and roll a joint on it. But, like, even that, then it's just like, well, I'm 37 at that point. Like... These days, I just don't, like, when it, thinking about doing drugs, it's like, fuck, I don't have time. Like, I have time to, like, have a couple of
beers.
You got a kid.
Well, I got a teeny tiny kid.
Yeah, I got a little kid that, like, wants to play with me, and, like, that's not, I can, like I said, I can have a couple of beers, I can feel mellow from a couple of beers, and, play with the kid and everything, but, like... getting high and or doing any other kind of drugs, like, even though I know, like, I keep thinking about trying kratom, but, like, even then it's like, I don't know what that does. Like, and I don't have an opportunity to like do it when I'm not around, when I can just be by myself to be like, okay, what does this do? How do I feel? And like in that point, then you start overanalyzing it, and then you just fuck up your own trip, and it's just like, yeah. I just don't want to. When my daughter is 18 and in her own apartment, then I can safely, you know, smoke weed, I think.
Yeah, kratom is just a body thing. It's not going to fuck with your head, really. I mean, you might feel a little like dizzy, like somewhat, but mostly it's just a whole body thing. It like the thing about it is, I was a painkiller addict when my daughter was born. I was hooked on opiates. I was taking like a shitload, like I could never find Oxycontin, so I was just taking like volume of like Percocets and Vicodin. And I went to rehab, and then I got clean for like 3 years. And when she turned, by the time she'd turned five, I got injured, and I started smoking weed again after I got injured when she was three, actually. And I became a stay-at-home dad. Like, it made me settle down, and it made me realize that I wanted to be there for the whole... I didn't want anything to keep me apart from my daughter as she was growing up through those first 5 or 6 years. And that's not everybody can do that, you know?
Yeah, but that's what got me to, like, chill out on my drinking, because I used to be getting trashed on a regular basis, and then we had the kid, and it's like, you know, you can't do that with a kid. Like, you can't be out of commission. Mm-hmm. Like that, you know. I can have a couple of beers, but like I have, like if I have a beer at five, I was like, okay, I can safely have three beers tonight, because I'll have a beer at five, and I'll have my, you know, another one at seven, and then another one at 11 or so. But, yeah, you know, I can't drink half a bottle of vodka like I used to do and get shitty.
It's a babysitter thing. Once you can do babysitter stuff, then that's when you can get a little freer, you know? Like, if you trust them enough. I mean, you might be more nervous than I was. Like, I have – my whole family lives around me because I live in the place that I grew up. A place I've barely even left. So I have like pretty deep roots here, and I could pass the kid off at times too. And
we give the kid to my in-laws, and she loves hanging out at Mimi and Papa's house. So
yeah, and like,
but you know, we always got to pick her up. She doesn't stay the night there, and that's the big thing, is, you know, then you got to eventually drive and get the kid, so you can't be fucked up for that,
right? Yeah, mine stays the night. But mine would stay the night a lot. Like, we would just let her stay over. And, yeah, we just did. Like, now she's 12, so she just fucking leaves for whole weekends at a time. So, I mean, I it's interesting talking to – I don't think I've had anybody on – I've had two 12-year-olds on the show, but anybody else on that has kids. So that's, like – or Brett has a daughter, obviously.
Right.
And yeah, man, I can tell you that when they're 12, you have a lot of time to yourself that you have to figure out what to do with.
Well, that's what my parents told me, cuz they had their first kid. My older brother, who is their first kid, is 17 and a half years older than me. And then my sister is 11 years older than me. So they were saying that when I was like 10 or 11, I went to YMCA summer camp, and it was a week-long summer camp, and you know, you stay there. Like, it's not a day camp. You stay there, and you sleep there, and you eat there and everything. And my dad was just like, this is the first time that we didn't have a kid in the house in like 25 years. We had no idea what to do with ourselves.
It's wild. I think a lot of Street Fight success right now is that, like, I was a stay-at-home dad for like 5 or 6 years, who volunteered at the school, who just, my whole life revolved around my daughter. And, you know, I would just do this podcast at the end of every 2 weeks just for fun, just as a hobby. And then, like, I got real serious about it once she turned like 11, and I realized, like, man, you know, she wants to go in her room and shut the door and watch TV and stuff like that, like, or talk on her phone and FaceTime with her friends and stuff like that. She doesn't She doesn't need me. I pop in and I talk to her as much as I can. And I do those shows with her. And she's also been going to some of our live shows. She just went to the one in Pittsburgh and she goes to most of them in Columbus. So, like, you know, we spend time going to our stuff, but she is just like, she thinks my job is cool now. I guess that's the thing. Because my daughter's dream job is internet celebrity. Like
that's the dream job of every 12-year-old.
Right. She's like, yeah, by the time, you know, when I get older and I have a very successful YouTube show, we can maybe get a bigger house. And I'm like, it's a tough market to break into, kid. I mean, yeah. She makes slime too. So
yeah. What? Okay. So I remember that. What is it? What do you do with slime?
You play with it.
Okay, well, so it's just like it's like GAC or something.
Yes, it is GAC. Okay. Yeah. They don't even really play with it either though. Like sometimes I'll see her playing with slime, but in really most of the time it sits in these containers on a table in her bedroom. And she's just like, "These are all my slimes. How do you like them?" You know what I like about it? Can I say one of the things I like about it though is like everything I collected was just some shit that somebody else made and I went and bought, like baseball cards or G.I. Joes. But she's like making the thing that she's collecting, which I think is one step better than what I was into. Oh shit, did we disconnect?
No, I got you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, one step. It was just one step different than what I was used, what I did. I admire the kids now a lot more. Like I don't know if this is the case, but I feel like even with the people that we talk to, I'm 38 years old and most of my audience is in their 20s, but some of it, a good portion of it in their early 20s. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like, everybody I talk to and all the people on Twitter that are a lot younger, they seem smarter than everybody I'm around.
Yeah, it's painful sometimes.
Yeah.
Just because like I'm constantly surrounded by people that like, and I have younger kids. I have youngest sibling syndrome where like I've always been surrounded by people older than me, so it confuses me to be the older person like in a room sometimes. And yeah, so I guess it's like, oh man, all these young people that are like so much smarter and doing so much more. Like at the age of 23, I was just like getting drunk and working a $12 an hour job at Kinko's. Like I wasn't doing anything important or radical or anything like that. But I mean, I guess at the time also it, you know, there wasn't a huge political push to do something like that. So it's cool to see a lot of, you know, and maybe it's just because I'm on Twitter and I follow a bunch of, you know, like-minded people. But it's cool to kind of see that happening and see that younger and younger people are getting more involved in what's going on.
Yeah, I love the idea. I love these guys that are like from my generation or that are writing articles now, like the millennials are okay, like really defending them. And they kind of deserve it. You know, they are good. I mean, a lot of them, the ones that I talk to, they seem a lot more tolerant than we were, and they seem a lot more willing to work with people than I ever felt that we ever got, you know?
Yeah, I think millennials, I think the biggest fear that a lot of people have of millennials is that the current, I mean, I think technically I am a millennial, I'm only 33, but the current like batch of people in their 20s are probably the closest step that we've been in decades towards any kind of left-leaning, any kind of socialism. Like that's, you know, you didn't have that 20 years ago. Everybody was just a Democrat, and if you were a communist, you were a damn communist and nobody wanted to talk to you. But now, like, you see all these younger people who have been handed like this, they've been handed a fucked up world. And they're like, this is messed up and capitalism has fucked us. Because all the people up top made their money and they're continuing to make their money and they're not letting go of any of that money. They're not spending it, or they're just trying to wring more and more out of us. And wouldn't it be great if we just smashed that whole upper echelon of people and kind of redistributed it to all the people who need it? Like, you know, I feel like there is that a lot more people, younger people, the people in their 20s are the ones who are like, this world's kind of fucked up and we should change that.
It's fucking, yeah, and you know, when you think about it, they were teenagers when Occupy was going on. So it probably, that was probably like pretty inspiring to them. And Occupy was a movement that was a little more radical. I mean, it was an anarchist movement, and it, that was its downfall. You know what I mean? Was like that there was nobody could
there's
get
no, the thing no to leadership, really.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because they were trying so hard to they were trying so hard to spread it. And like I'm the type of person who I'm an anarchist, like to the core. Like to I want my ideal society and what I want is just an egalitarian thing. Everybody's just starts on the same level, you know, and you have a basic way of life until you're fully realized, you know, in my dream world. But I also recognize that we live in a world that has never been anarchist. You know, there's never been anarchism on the I mean, you know, these tiny small pockets of it. So we're going to have to incrementally get there. But like where I differ with like people who believe in the incremental thing is like, we need to be like three steps past the Democrats now. Like we're way behind,
yeah.
You know, to moving to the left. I really think that like, if I try to articulate that to people who think that the anarcho comedy show is like a like a gimmick or anything, and that we're anarchists, like we're fake anarchists because Brett works with the DSA. And I talk to anybody, basically. I call myself, I guess, left. Like, that's how I identify, you know. But, like, I guess my goal is to engage people who just aren't even voting to see if we can get them to feel like they deserve that power. Like, when you talk about smashing that top, that 1%, and smashing all their stuff and redistributing it, I can't imagine why somebody down on our level wouldn't like have that be one of the goals in their political movement, you know?
Because they think that one day that they'll be there, that
yeah.
that they are just temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Like, I don't have $1 million yet, but one day I will, and I need to, you know, help protect those people for when I get there eventually. And it's like, dude, you are 37 years old and you are a manager at a Whataburger. Like, you're not getting there. You're not getting there. And that's fine. Like, not everybody's going to be a millionaire. I've given up on that dream a long time ago. My father still plays the Powerball. That's about the closest I'll ever get.
Oh, I love Powerball, though. I love the lottery. Is like, that's probably how if I'm going to become a rich man, lottery is the only way that's going to work. Or if I get on like a game show or something, right, and get real successful at that.
But you know, one of the things that I think that kind of going back, I've always kind of had this thought that the younger generation, the people who are in their 20s, they don't have a fear that you and I did of I guess 9/11. They don't have that ingrained in them as adults and as that kind of fear. I see a lot of people on Twitter, like every time 9/11 rolls around, like, oh, I was in eighth grade when this happened. And I think that that's why there's a big push now to change the way things are. Because after 9/11, we saw, you know, the Patriot Act, and we saw a lot of people just, even Democrats suddenly become, you know, very tote the flag and fight the wars and stop all of this.
That was my most right wing moment was, yeah. I was very right wing after 9/11, like not a moderate, not a Democrat. I was like a Republican's Republican, you know. I was so fucking conservative. I just wasn't like,
I was in basic training when it happened. Like, so let me tell you, that whipped us into a frenzy. We're all ready to go to fucking war at that point. And you don't have that fear with somebody who is like, well, there I was in fifth grade. Like, they don't have, because at that point, you know, a fifth grader doesn't really realize what's going on. The weight of something like a terrorist attack on that scale just doesn't weigh on them. So that's why I feel like I guess the socialist movement is really coming up now, because there's nothing that a 23-year-old in 2017 has that they're afraid of. There is no, you know, the Iraq War, Afghanistan, that wasn't something, I mean, that's something obviously they grew up with, but they probably didn't have, like, kind of self-realized themselves, because it didn't touch them. It wasn't something that they were a part of. And now they look at it as like, that's fucked up. Why are we still in Iraq? Why are we still in Afghanistan? Why are we fucking around with Syria? None of this stuff makes sense.
Right.
You know, I feel like 9/11, like you said, I mean, it made you super right wing. I mean, it did the same to me. I think it did the same to a lot of people. And we're starting to come out of that, which is great. But you've got a generation behind us that never had that.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's where the big push left is coming from right now, is these 22, 23-year-olds who are getting out of college with, you know, $80,000 worth of debt and getting a $12 an hour job and saying, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like, I even see a lot more people talking about slashing the defense budget. You know what I mean? And taking some of that and giving it to, you know, spreading it out as social programs. And like, man, if you had said that in 2003 or something, I mean, like, I can't imagine what kind of fervor that would have whipped up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and we talked about that on our podcast.
I listened to that show when you guys talked about, I wanted to bring that up, actually, when you guys talked about the ways that the military has wasted money, and you gave like very specific examples.
Oh,
I fucking love that show.
And I tell you, there is anytime anybody brings up the whole welfare queen thing, I always have so many things in my back pocket. I mean, the government at one point, I don't know if you've heard this, the government at one point, this is probably like back, God, 60s, 70s or something like that. Back when we had a bunch of money and we really didn't know what we were doing, so we were just kind of trying shit out. There was an experiment that was done where they put a woman in a house that was like filled up kind of with water, and they put a dolphin in there with her, because they were trying to get to a point where, like, dolphins are smart. We know dolphins are really smart for an animal. Can we, if we put a person, if we put a lady into this thing with this dolphin, will they eventually be able to communicate with one another? And then, of course, can we use these dolphins for war? So the fucked up thing.
That's some science Brent and I would come up with.
It gets even better, because dolphin, okay, so every animal has sex to procreate, but only a select few animals have sex for fun. One of them is humans, and one of them is dolphins.
Yeah,
so
I have
this
heard.
Dolphin started to get horny and actually started to like attack the woman because he wasn't getting his rocks off. So the scientists were like, well, we don't want to fuck up this experiment, and actually maybe having some kind of a sexual relationship with the dolphin will help out. So she had to like jerk the dolphin off on regular intervals.
Jesus.
And after that, the dolphin was like, oh yeah, hey, cool. And they're like, okay, great. So you and the dolphin have more of a connection now. And well, of course it didn't work.
No.
So then
that's
the government,
Brett, that's street fight science right there.
Oh,
that's what
oh,
that
we got,
is.
We got one more, Brian, because at the time the government had this brand new fancy drug that they were trying out called LSD. So they said, what if we give the dolphin LSD and we give the lady LSD and we put them into the house? Let's see what happens. Now, of course, we do not do this anymore. Because it was a horrible failure of an experiment. But it is something that we tried out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was really struck. One of your co-hosts talked about a new system that they were going to use, some new tech thing. And he said when they came to him and they said, hey, we have this new tech thing, he was like, I don't want that. You know, like the first inclination was for him to say, I don't need it. The thing I have is fine. But when you guys talked about it, he kind of made it sound to me like they forced him to take it. Like it wasn't like he didn't have a choice but to take this new expensive equipment that he didn't want.
Yeah, and that's, you know, plenty of times. And you get it, and what you do is you say, okay, I have it, I'll sign for it, and I'll put it in this little box, and I'll put it over here in a corner, and we'll never talk about it again. The same thing with our Abrams tanks. Like, tanks, we don't use tanks in very many situations. Like,
it
they don't work
weird.
In Iraq or Afghanistan, but we still make tanks on a regular basis because somebody in Ohio, that where the tank factory is like, no, nah, we're not going to shut down the tank factory, so
you
make
gotta
more
do
tanks.
It. That's one thing we that's something I think about a lot, like the Obama, the conceit of the Affordable Care Act. One of the conceits of the Affordable Care Act was that, like, well, you can't get rid of the insurance companies or you'll get rid of an awful lot of jobs. It would, like, there would be a lot of jobs lost in Columbus, Ohio, because it's like a nationwide insurance. Like, it's one of the biggest employers, but, like, you can't just say, well, people are going to die from preventable diseases or preventable health incidents so that we can make sure that these middle class people have an easy job that they can sit in a chair and do.
Right. And I mean, you can still, you know, and that's the thing. It's like the coal miners. Like, people are worried about, well, what are the coal miners going to do? It's like, what if we stopped the coal mining? We took all the coal miners and we said, okay, we're going to put you all through, we're going to pay for you to go to the school, and we're going to pay for your living expenses and everything. We're going to give you a salary, and you're all going to learn how to become the wind repair people, or you're all going to learn how to become hydroelectric repair people.
Or solar panels.
Yeah, you're going to learn how to install solar panels. Like, it's not completely, like, out of the question. It's just that the problem that we run into, it's just like why we don't invest in education. We can't see long term. We can't, you know, nobody's worried about the sun blowing up in 20 million years because that's 20 million years from now. And the same thing comes from 10 years from now. Like, we can't, you know, it's difficult to say to somebody, look, if you invest in education, if you invest in these renewable energies, we're going to, in 10 to 15 years, we're going to start seeing some great returns because these kids are going to get properly educated, and we're going to have clean energy, and we're going to, you know, not be reliant on energy coming in. We've got wind for fucking days in this country. We've got a huge country full of planes. Like, it is not hard. We got a huge country that gets a lot of sun. Like, there's no reason why we can't do something like this. But as soon as you say, and we will see results in 15 years, you suddenly hear the brakes start getting pumped. It's like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Well, what about tomorrow? Like, you're talking about spending a lot of money today to have something later on, to have something in 15 years. And it's unfathomable. It's like, well, what can we do to fix things in a year? It's like, well, fucking nothing. We can continue to put a Band-Aid on something. And then they're like, no, that's fine. Put the Band-Aid on. Put the Band-Aid on.
Yeah.
We're going to continue to need the health insurance companies. We need those people. We need those people to have jobs. It's like, we can get them to do something else, or we can, you know, I don't know, do some kind of universal basic income, do something. Like, it's not a completely unfathomable thing that we have here. We can do something about it. But like I said, as soon as you say 15, 20 years in the future, people stop responding at that point, because 20 years in the future is too far ahead to think. Nobody's thinking. People think about their 5-year plan. They don't think about their 20-year plan.
No, and bringing, like, this has been something that Brett and I have talked about in the past. It's like, we're anti-war, right? And like, going to other places and doing war, I think, is the wrong decision. Okay? Like, almost, I mean, pretty much all the time, I think. I can't argue against all the wars, because I'm frankly very stupid. But I think, like, there's still a space to have soldiers, I guess, that were here and, like, doing stuff. You know what I mean? Like, that they got to get cut out. They got to get cut out from the military. Once you're done with the military, you have to go get a private job. Like, they don't put you on a fucking road construction crew or something, you know, give you something that you can do. I don't understand why, like, and like you said, justifying that amount of money that they're spending to fly people all around the world to cause problems, like, to not necessarily fix anything. Usually they just make a big mess and then they gotta, you know, stay there forever, apparently, is the philosophy. And but there's things that can be done here for them, and they could have a job here without going there, and that would save a hell of a lot of money. You know what I mean? That's it. It's like there's so much that can be cut without cutting the wages of the people that are in the military, I guess, because that's really what they say the problem is, that they don't want to cut the defense budget, because they make it sound like, and they probably will, the first people that lose money are the soldiers, are going to get their pay cut. Yeah.
Yeah. We lose money first. I mean, even with this federal hiring freeze that Trump did, soldiers in Germany have lost their childcare. So they're, you know, any American troops in Germany have to find alternative childcare, because the military provided that at one point, but they can't now because there's a federal hiring freeze. And that's how it always is. It's like, well, we're going to save money by not hiring any more, you know, federal employees. It's like, no, my dude, that's not the answer here. The answer is don't build two more aircraft carriers. We have 12. Yeah. The next country that has any aircraft carriers is Italy, and it's two, and they're selling one.
You could build a city out of aircraft carriers. You could build a huge city in the middle of the ocean out of aircraft carriers now.
Drag the aircraft carrier up onto the banks in Louisiana, and all the people that are displaced in Katrina can live in the aircraft carrier. And if another storm comes around, it's an aircraft carrier. It flooded. It's just going to float.
I love this. I love this idea. We have so many things that we could repurpose from the military, and we could save, like I said, full socialism. It is the most it's the most wasteful of the things that wastes our money. And it's looked at as a no-go zone when it comes to cutting. It's like, we can't cut there. But you're right. Why would we use tanks now? It's like, not even, can you even think of a place where we would use tanks?
If for whatever reason we kicked off some ground war with Russia or China, sure. But, you know, in our current conflicts, the door-to-door stuff that we do in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's no reason for them. And like I said, we don't use them. We don't even use Humvees anymore. We use the MRAPs, the big ones that all the police departments have now, those big mine-resistant things. Like, we use those because, you know, a mine blows up, you know, an IED blows up underneath it, and it, you know, you're fairly safe inside of them. But yeah, a big old tank just doesn't do anything. Like, it's completely useless. It'll get stuck all sorts of places. And, you know, that giant fucking gun, you're not going to use it. The only thing to use that giant gun against is other tanks, or like as some kind of like improvised artillery thing. But you've already got, you know, we don't need the tank. We have things that do everything the tank does. So there's no reason to bring the tank in.
And they make them, are they making them right now? You know, like, are there new ones being made all the time?
I believe so, but we also sell a lot of tanks. I know Australia and Britain has their own. There's a handful of countries that buy tanks off of us. I know we sold a bunch to the Iraqi army too. While I was in Iraq, the first shipment of Abrams tanks were dropped off while I was there. So they're definitely, like, other places use them, but like in our current war situation, like, it's very, you know, just thinking about war tactics in 2017, and I'm sure that there are, you know, military wonks out there who know much more about.
Probably not in this audience though.
Yeah. But, you know, honestly, no, I can't think of any reason to have a tank for any reason.
That
tank factory that is up there in Ohio, just retrofit it to make something else. Like, you got a factory that builds shit, like, reprogram it. I know it's gonna cost some money. I know that, you know, you can't just turn around and start doing something else, but you can. You know,
they just opened a big, this huge Amazon thing here. They can all go work there. They're always hiring.
Well, that's a factory job to a shitty Amazon job. Yeah. We'll organize Amazon, and then we'll bring all the tank people over to work Amazon.
I want to organize Uline now. That's a new, like, Do you know the company Uline?
Yeah, I listened to, I heard that podcast about when you guys talked about Uline.
I got a thing in my DMs today about Uline from somebody who knows an employee that works there, and it is bad news. I want to, like, that is the place we need to unionize first, I think. That would be a huge symbolic victory. Because, I mean, they'd probably just go out of business. They would rather go out of business than have a union.
Yeah.
All right, Francis. Thank you for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I love doing shows with new people, and we got to talk about things that I don't think have ever been discussed, like, in a mature way on this radio show. It's just, like, I always feel, like, so weird about, like, I have another friend that doesn't listen to the show, but that was in the military that is, I would say, more left than most people in the military, you know. He's still pretty conservative to me. But he doesn't listen to the show, and I'm always, like, thankful when I see him, because I'm like, man, like, I know that the people that choose to do this do it for a number of reasons. You know, it's not just bloodthirsty people. It's people that had maybe in no other options or just made a choice just like all of us did, and they ended up in a job that I disagree, like, you know what I mean, that I disagree yeah. with the use, and like I think about when I think about you listening, I'm even like, I feel bad. You're the only troop I know, and I'm always like, I feel bad when I do this, but it's like just something, like, it's part of what we do, what we've always done.
I don't think I've ever been offended by anything that I've heard on Street Fight, so you don't have to worry about that for me.
Yeah, no, I don't think you would get offended about it. We're conditioned to believe that you guys are, like, very sensitive. You know, you can't ever right. say anything about them, or they just, all the morale goes away, and then the military doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, there's plenty of people like that, but if anybody gets, like, mad about, like, first off, anybody who's like that is not listening to Street Fight anyway.
Hell
so
no.
You don't have to worry about that. And anybody who does, like, get pissed off about something like that, I mean, fuck them. Like, you know, you've made your choice to join the military, you know, own it. And you can, be, you know, you, guess what? You fight for the freedom for Street Fight to be on 3 times a week.
Yeah, but that always makes them mad.
Yeah.
But I'll say this. I love your show. Like, I listen to it pretty much every week, you know, and I really like it. And I think it gives me an insight into the military that I would never have gotten in any other place. Like, I can't think of another person who could do a show about the military that could get me to tune in with any regularity. And I think your show is really good, man. And you're doing good work.
Yeah, and that's what we're going for, is to kind of bridge that gap between, you know, us and the civilian world. And I know it's always been a thing, like, the military's always tried to do something like that, and then here's me is like, well, I got this podcast about being a socialist in the military, and I'm waiting for us to get big enough that the army ends up taking notice and like trying to shut me down. It's like, nah, man, you can't. This isn't.
Yeah, you're playing that game of, like, Brett and I are, like, things are starting to take off more and more, and we have this, like, archive of things, and we tend to say terrible things, and I'm like, one of these days we're going to end up on Fox News. Like, they're just going to pick some piece of audio from the show and say, you know, we hate cops or we hate the troops. I mean, I have more of a problem with cops. I mean, the troops that I've met have honestly all been pretty nice to me. I've never had anybody that disliked me, and I talk politics with everybody. You know, when you do what I do and you meet other people out in, like, real life, they'll inform, like, immediately, oh, he's, you know, don't talk about politics around
right
him, you know, because he's gonna do politics stuff. And a lot of those people see that as a challenge and want to argue with me, so I do end up in a fair amount of arguments with people. But I've never found that you shut me down, and the other guy that I know shut me down. You're the only two troops I know, though, so who knows?
Well, like, if you met Nate and Adrian, I think you'd get along with them too. So
yeah, I love those guys, man. I let them know. I do like your show, and I listen. I listen quite a bit. I've been there since day one. I listened to the shows that just had you on them.
Ugh, those are terrible.
Well, you should listen to some early street fights.
No, I don't. I do that. I do that service to every podcast. I don't go back to the first episode.
Oh God! Well, you couldn't find ours. Probably it's 6 years old. We've done like 300 and something shows, but like even stuff we were doing like 2 years ago, I'm like, ugh, God, that sucks. Like it's just you never feel comfortable with yourself.
Ever. Well, and that's good because you're always improving.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the show, man, and see you next week, listeners. All right. You can.